Okay, so in 2004, something unprecedented happened in the world of professional poker. Professional poker is, you know, poker is like a boys' thing, but this woman named Annie Duke, for the first time, won like the big jackpot. There's no winner of the World Series of Poker. It's not. There's no like final game. But if you get a big jackpot, $2 million, that's like pretty solid. Then that counts as winning. That's and so Annie Duke. Duke was the first female to get one of these big, massive jackpots. So I don't know if any of us play poker, but it's okay. There are better things that we can spend our time doing than gambling. But the whole, but you can appreciate that playing poker is not just a game of luck. Like at a certain point, you need to know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so, for Annie Duke to win the World Series of Poker, she must have been really good. Hmm? Makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. But no. In an NPR interview, she said this. I went in there with this incredible fear that my play that was in front of cameras would prove that everyone was right. I was actually a terrible player, despite the fact that I'd spent the last 10 years making my living playing poker at the highest level of the game. That I didn't really deserve to have ever won anything, and I was bad, and I had just gotten lucky, and everyone would know it. You know, imagine, you know, the lights, and there's replays, and there's commentators talking about God knows what, because it's poker, but they're talking. And everyone's going to be like, how did she keep winning? But does that make any sense? She won. For 10 years, she's been winning at poker. 10 years is a long time to consistently succeed. And yet, Annie Duke feels like she's not successful. And so what we're going to look at today is three different times in, you could say, our history of the Torah that people seemingly feel a little bit like Annie Duke, where they feel like, you know, they're succeeding, that they're accomplishing, and yet they don't feel like they're supposed to. And the first one, it connects to the, you know, parsha that we're learning now with Moshe. Moshe is like a crazy story because at 80 years old, Moshe is, you know, he's out, he's a shepherd, and he sees this burning bush. This is a story we're probably familiar with. And God says, I want you to take the Jewish people out of Egypt. Now, if God said, I want to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, what would you say?
Yes. Whatever you say.
Okay. But what does Moshe say? I don't know. Maybe not. I don't think it's a good idea. He says, you know what? Take my brother Aaron. Aaron should do it. I'm not going to. And God's like, no. It's you. You're the man. I want you to take the Jewish people out. And Moshe says, no. And he says, no and no and no over and over and over again. For a full week, they're standing. You can, like, imagine. Moses is standing there. He's got, like, his shepherd's staff. Probably not the whole elaborate beard because he's not a rabbi yet. But he's standing there and he's yelling at a bush saying, no, I'm not going. I'm not going to lead the Jewish people out. This isn't a job for me. And the bush is yelling back at him, no, you should go. And he keeps making the same argument over and over and over again. Not a man of words. Lo ish dvarim anochi. Which is, it's a fair argument. If Moses is going to take the Jewish people out of Egypt, then he should probably be a good orator. I was just in LA because we had Martin Luther King Day off. Martin Luther King, he didn't lead the black people out of slavery, but he led a whole civil rights movement that was not so different, and he used a lot of allusions to Moshe, to a lot of the same things that Moses said. He says Moses was not a man of words, though. He wasn't an orator. And so Moses, even though God is telling him, I think that you would be the right person, Moses is like, no, not happy, I can't do it. And so why is Moses consistently saying, no, it's not happening, I can't do it, when God himself is telling him? Now remember, there's a miracle happening in front of him. There's a bush that's on fire, but like not being consumed. If God tells you to do something, you got to listen. Moses said no. And that's Moses. We're going to try and understand why does Moses keep saying no. And we're going to look at someone else. We're going to go back a few weeks in the Parshiot to the story between Rachel and Jacob and Yaakov. This is a tough time. I assume that none of you have... All of you only have one husband, and your husbands only have one wife.
It's a good assumption.
Well, it's not easy having two.
That's so true, though.
I was just in LA, and I heard some interesting stories, but we don't have to get into all that. Midwest.
No, lots, actually. That's good.
But that's not the case with Jacob and Rachel. Jacob has four wives, but he really has two wives. And it's not just that he has two wives. It's very, very challenging because both of them really want to be mommies. And One of them is just like popping kids out over and over again, nonstop. Leia has four kids, like all in a row. And she's just like always pregnant. There's like a shower every week. Weekend, it's then a shower, then it's a bris, and then a baby naming, and all these things are happening. And Rachel, her sister, is sitting there just watching, not having any children. I don't know when everyone, if everyone has kids, they want everyone's had kids, but it's challenging for a lot of people when they want to be a parent and they can't. For Rachel, it's so much worse because her husband has kids and her sister has kids, not just the other wife, but it's her sister. It's a lot. It's not easy for her. And so she's having a tough time. And so one day, her husband Jacob's just sitting there. He's probably sitting as like his lazy boy. He's got like a nice cold iced tea. And you know, he's reading the paper or magazine, something. He's just hanging out. And she comes in. And he says, "Hi, honey." And he has no clue what he's in for. Because she screams at him. "Why don't you love me? Why don't you care about me? I thought I was your favorite wife, and yet you clearly don't. You clearly don't love me. Why don't you love me?" So I've only been on one side of that conversation. I can't tell what it's like from the other. But he's frazzled. He doesn't really know what's going on. He doesn't know what he did wrong, which is frequently the case. He's like, "I just don't know what's flying." And he says, "What do you mean? Like, what do you mean? I don't. Of course I love you. You know, I don't know if he said you're my favorite wife, but." But he says, "Of course I love you. Of course I care about you. How can you even think that I wouldn't love you?" And she says, "Well, you're this big, big righteous Sadiq guy. You pray all the time, and one of your wives has all these kids. Leia's got all these kids, but I don't. Seemingly, it's because you are doing something. You're praying for her. You're doing something for her. You're not doing for me. Why don't you love me? Why don't you pray for me?" And then Yaakov, our dear father, does something that does not seem to be a good idea. We can look inside in case you don't believe me. In the first line in Source 3, she gets upset at him and says, "You don't give me children, I may as well be dead. It's not worth living." And in the second line, Jacob, Pasuk Bet, says, "Vayicharav Yaakov Baracha." He yells at her, he gets upset. Now, if your wife comes to you, I'm not an expert, I've only been married 4 years, but I think if your wife comes to you saying, "Honey, I'm so sad we don't have children," getting upset at her is probably not the best move.
No.
But he yells at her, and he says, "I'm not God. What do you want from me? Talk to God. It's not me who's preventing you from having children. God is." So that's like an interesting response, but it's not infactual. But when you look at the way Rashi explains the conversation, it's a lot worse. Because what Rashi basically says was that Rachel sees that Leah's got children, and she's jealous, and she said, "You know, I really, really want children. You know, your father prayed for Rivka to have children, and I want you to pray for me to have children." Seemingly, it's up to the husband. You know, nowadays, like, there's always the conversation about whose fault it is that it's not happening, which is very unhealthy. Is it his fault or her fault? Here, the same conversation's happening, just without all the fertility testing. And then in the bottom Rashi says, "Asher menami mecha, ato merit she esak abba." You want me to do like my father did. You want me to pray for you the same way my dad did. Ani eni kabba, but I'm not like my father. My father, Yitzchak and Rivka, didn't have children, so they were both davening to have children. And we say that Yitzchak, you know, he was very righteous, and his father was righteous, so his prayers might have had a little bit more oomph to them than Rivka, who was only righteous herself. Her father wasn't. Okay, fine. But Yaakov is like, "Well, I'm not like my dad. Abba lo hayu lo bani. My dad didn't have kids, but I do have kids. I have all these children with your sister. I don't need to pray for your children."
Not so nice. It's
you who's not having children, not me. So the fact that Yaakov lived through this scene is very impressive. That might be a miracle worth exploring another time. But what in the world is going on? So the Ramban understands it a little bit differently, and not exactly that Yaakov was just like the most thoughtless husband in the entire world, but rather a little bit differently. Because the words are there. and Rashi's commenting on the words, you know, God denied you children, not me. Yaakov does say that. But what Yaakov is telling Rachel is that you can't assume that I'm going to be the only one who can daven. You can't assume that it's all up to me. You have to daven also. I've been davening. I daven for you every day. But are you davening? And the Ramban says that, shockingly, Rachel wasn't davening. Which doesn't make a lot of sense, because, you know, if we think about it, you know, our Jewish songs, you know, Mama Rachel, Rachel crying for her children, that's like a big thing that Rachel does. She davens all the time. And yet, she's not davening to have kids. Why in the world would Rachel not daven to have kids? That's our second question. Now we're going to ask one more, third question. About someone who, like, I think a lot of us, like, know about, but we don't really know that much about, Shaul, King Saul, who, like, you know, like, he's there, you know, he was the king before David, but, like, how much do we really know about him? Basically, he was the man. He was awesome. I threw a few various psukim together, but, you know, if we look in beginning of source 4, and so this guy named Kish has a son named Shaul, and there was no one who was more handsome. He was taller than everyone else. He was the big man on campus. The next chapter, I didn't put it in, but the next chapter, basically, he's looking off for donkeys, and he meets some girls, and basically, they start flirting with him because he's so attractive. And he's really impressive. And then when he's crowned king, Shmuel the Navi, sort of the leader at the time, points to him and says, Jewish people, what do you think of this guy? Do we like him? And they scream out, long live the king. This guy's awesome. We're such a fan. We love King Shaul. We love King Saul. And look, and this is just a cute story that you know, community sends. Nowadays, you know, when the community is looking for a rabbi, they'll reach out to, I don't know what they do. They post something online, maybe. You know, in Chicago, I know they're reaching out to Yeshiva University, but they'll do something to try and find a rabbi. But, you know, back in the day, it's not so different. You know, they'll reach out to, like, a local, you know, big rabbi and say, do you have any students that can be the rabbi for our community? So they reach out, and the rabbi says, yeah, I've got a wonderful student, and he sends him, and he's this, like, little, like, scrawny guy, like, not so impressive looking, not so impressive sounding, and they're like, do you have another one? This is coming another size, like maybe another color, like something. This isn't really what we're looking for. And so he says, oh, you're looking for a rabbi. Okay, fine. Follow me. He takes him down into the kitchen and introduces them to the head chef. He's a big guy. He's got a nice full beard, deep voice. Or he says, you're looking for you know, a rabbi, someone who looks and sounds and stately and impressive. This guy's stately and impressive. He couldn't tell you. He can't be a spiritual leader for you. He doesn't really know much beyond chef things, but he looks like it. And so Shaul seemingly he's the full package because he looks it. He's got the look. He's got the feel. You look at him, he's like, oh, that guy looks like a king. Like, when we talk about you know, someone looking like a president, you know, when you look at Barack Obama and he's like this, he's attractive, he's tall, he's got like a deep voice, a great orator. That guy like looks like he should be president. Look at some of our other presidents, and you're like, how did they get elected? this was like a big thing in, I guess we're talking the 60s, when Nixon was running against JFK. JFK is this like young, charismatic, really attractive guy, and Nixon was like old-fashioned, not so old, but definitely older than JFK, and refused to wear makeup on television. And they're like, Nixon, you gotta wear makeup on television, and he wouldn't do it. And so it was the first televised debate, and JFK, I mean, he sounds good, but he also looks great.
Right.
Looks great, and he's wearing whatever makeup he needs to wear. He probably was always wearing makeup, I don't know. But Nixon, he's like sweating under the lights, and he looks terrible, and like the camera's on him, and everyone's like, we are not voting for this guy. So eventually they do vote for him. But JFK wins, even though he's superbly less experienced, and there were so many reasons why you would assume he wouldn't be elected. He was the only Catholic ever elected. But he looked good. And a lot of times we're looking for that statesman. But now here you got the full package in King Saul. He's attractive. He's stately. He's also righteous. He's a great guy.
They didn't want him.
Huh?
They didn't want him.
They did want him.
Oh, they didn't
and
want
they're
him.
All excited about him.
But the other people didn't.
But, so I haven't been inside all the classrooms in Ida Crown. But I know that in some of the classrooms in Krishna growing up, there were like posters and signs in like some of my Hebrew classes. So I'd be sitting in Hebrew class. Hebrew class or Tanakh class or Gemara class, whatever the class was, and doing anything but listening, because that's what students do. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's a great educational tool to put information around the room, because when kids space out, they end up accidentally learning things. And so there's like a sign that I can like picture. I tried finding it, putting it on the page, but it's not accessible online. But I can almost like draw it out for you. Mm-hmm. That it's a white and purple sign, and it was the kings of Israel. And so the kingdom splits later on, and so you've got the two sides. But the top is King Saul, King David, Solomon. Okay, and then it's got number of years. And so for Shlomo, for Solomon, 40 years. Great, that's a nice solid amount of time. David, 40 years, solid amount of time. Shaul, do we know how long he was king?
Very briefly.
2 years. This guy's the man! How's he only king for 2 years? What's going on? These are our three questions. These three instances in which people who are so eminently qualified, who seemingly could or should be succeeding, could or should be doing something, and yet they're not. Moshe's unwilling to lead the Jewish people out, even though God is like, I think you're the man. You're the guy for it. And given that he created everyone and is running the show and this bush is burning, it would appear that that was a good idea. But Moshe says no. Rachel's not praying when seemingly she should be praying for children. And King Saul doesn't make it. He can't become king. He can't stay king longer than 2 years. Now is the picture section of our evening. We got a bunch of them. So we're talking about Barack Obama, but let's think about Michelle, our hometown hero, Michelle Obama. She's put out this super, super successful award-winning bestseller book of Becoming, and she's doing the book set, the book tour. The night before the book tour, she says that she's about to go to the United Center. We love the United Center. And she says, I still remember waking up in a bit of a panic the night before my first tour event in the United Center in Chicago, in her hometown, where she grew up, where everyone loved her, where her husband was elected to the Senate. It's not just like, oh, the country at large. This is after she's been first lady for 8 years. She was like one of the most beloved first ladies that we've ever had. For sure the most active with the people. And she's going to be in Chicago. And she says, this is a huge basketball arena. You know, were people really going to come? Was it going to be any good? What? She's freaking out that people are not going to show up to her first event. But like, why would you ever imagine that the first lady, people wouldn't want to come? And it's not just Michelle Obama, it's not just people today. You can look back at Albert Einstein, the smartest guy to ever live, super genius, he like changed the world. He's got a great line. He says, the exaggerated esteem in which my life work is held makes me very ill at ease. I feel compelled to think of myself as an involuntary swindler. He's convinced that he's got everyone fooled, everyone tricked. That he's really not so impressive. He's like, yeah, I kind of like invented the atom bomb, but like, it wasn't really me. I'm not so good. And Maya Angelou, this tremendous author, said, they're going to figure out, that I'm not really so impressive. I don't really have that much to offer. What are all these people? What's going on both in our characters in Tanakh and in our character and in our modern day heroes? It's this thing called imposter syndrome. Now I studied psychology in college. Oftentimes in Yeshiva University, you'll have future rabbis studying psychology, which is ironic because I have a friend who is now a doctor of psychology, and he's like been trained, and he knows what he's doing, and he commented to me that anyone who has a bachelor's in psychology should never, ever practice psychology. That's a terrible idea, because you've got like all these theories going on in your head, but you can't actually put any of them into practice. So I am not qualified to counsel anyone, but I am qualified to talk about ideas. And I think I want to diagnose our heroes with imposter syndrome. Now, what's imposter syndrome? Good question. Imposter syndrome, coined. I'd say invented, but it was coined. It was realized.
It's real?
Oh, yeah.
Is that your term?
No. Okay. I'm not coming up with new psychological ideas. No, it's just...
I've never used that diagnosis.
Are you a psychologist?
I'm a social worker. I'll say okay.
All right, very impressed.
With a bachelor's in psychology.
She'll let you know if it's true.
So actually,
is it in the DSM?
So, imposter syndrome is not in the DSM. Oh. It's not an official diagnosis. Okay. That's really the difference. And so, is it a thing? I think most people would agree that it's a thing. Is it something that you can diagnose? Is it you're gonna put it on your chart? Probably. It's probably not a good idea.
Right. I won't.
It's a manifestation of a few different diagnoses sort of put together. Like a perfect storm almost, but we'll explain in a moment. 1978, there's two women, Dr. Pauline Clance and Suzanne Imes. Suzanne Imes is also a doctor. And they're looking around. They're seeing all these women, particularly women. It's more common with women, who feel like they're like frauds. They're like fakes. That they're not really qualified to be doing what they're doing. And they did research. They were tracking it. And it's super common. A few years later, now Cynthia Katz and Joan Harvey, they described it as a pattern rooted in intense, concealed feelings of fraudulence when faced with achievement tasks. So, what does imposter syndrome actually look like? Basically, it's a person who's accomplishing, someone who's capable, who feels like they're not really capable, they're not really deserving of accomplishment. You know, they got lucky, or like it was a circumstance that took place, or you know, it worked at this time, but it's not going to repeat itself. You know, I'm not actually good at this. I'm not actually talented. It's just like, okay, it worked out this way. You know, there was no one else who could do the job, so they gave me the promotion. But never that, you know, I'm a value, that I'm a worth. And so I don't think that having low self-esteem is a diagnosis. But it's a combination of a lack of self-esteem, but not just a lack of self-esteem. It's a lack of self-esteem, even though there's compelling evidence to suggest that that's totally doesn't make any sense. Or you'll have someone like Albert Einstein, who's like, yeah, I don't think that I'm so impressive. I don't think I've really accomplished much. You know, Maya Angelou's, I'm convinced that my work's not good. This poker player, Annie Duke, was like, yeah, I don't think that I really deserve to won so many times. And so imposter syndrome actually plagues a lot of people. These aren't official numbers, but what's discussed, you know, there are books and articles about this, a gazillion articles you can find, and like people talking about talk shows. It's like, my friend told me not to describe it as pop psychology because pop psychology sounds like it's not real. It's a real thing, but it's also like exciting and fun to talk about. And so about a third of people live with this all the time, and at some point in their lives, about 70% of people feel this way. They're like, I don't know how I got here. I have numerous friends who I'll ask them. I'm like, I have this friend named Jesse. He works in banking, and I'm like, you studied environmental economics. How do you know how to do finance things in the bank? He's like, I just make it up as I go, and they seem to be happy with what I'm doing. I have a friend who's in consulting, and I'm like, how did you convince people to fly you out all over the country to consult on things when like you didn't study those things? And he's like, I tricked them. But that's super common. The whole like fake it till you make it is not just like a joke that people make. It that's how most people operate in business, in their professional life. And to some extent, you know, there's a learning curve once you get there, but a lot of people just kind of feel like, yeah, I just kind of make it up as I go, and no one knows any better. I have a friend who was a rabbi for 10 years. 10 years. That's like a long time. In like a real city, not in like one of these little out-of-town, like tiny little places where no one's familiar with anything. He's a rabbi in a substantial real city, and he's like, yeah, basically every day I just assume that someone's going to knock on my door and be like, yeah, so we come to understand that you're actually a total fraud and you don't really know what you're doing and a lot of stuff you say is made up. We're going to want your rabbi card back. But he's like, it hasn't happened, so I just keep rolling with it. So I used to think like this, and to some extent I still do, but I've come to realize that this is super unhealthy. But it comes up all the time. So it's not just professional, though. I mean, it comes up in our personal lives. You can have a first-time mother who's like, oh my gosh, I don't know how to be a mom. It's like, I'm sure no one has felt like this.
Every day, I'm like, you're alive. Every day, I'm like, someone entrusted me with these children? What? Yeah. Bad
so
idea.
One of my friends was like, he lives in New York. He's like, in order to get my license, I had to study, take a test. I had to log like 60 or 100 hours of practice driving with someone who knows how to drive. Then I had to take a test for them to test whether or not I actually know how to drive. And then they gave me a license saying, you're allowed to drive a motorized vehicle. But my wife and I walked in, we had a baby, they gave it back to me and said, good luck. This is a human life, but you just go. And so many people are like, I don't know what I'm doing. Emma Katz really is awesome. I'll just tell you something she told my wife and I. That she was on the subway when she was pregnant. And when you're pregnant for your first child, you're very nervous about all the things. You have to make sure you're eating right, you're doing all the right things, staying away from like secondhand smoke and radiation, who knows. And she like saw these two people on the subway who We'll just say they didn't look like they were totally with it, and they were like two kids who like seemed like totally fine with them. She's like, if they are managing to raise these kids, like, I'll probably be okay. And so, yeah, kids are resilient, and it works out, but a lot of times people are like walking around, and it's like science fair, and like all the other kids have like awesome projects, and you're like, why doesn't my kid have a good project? Was I supposed to like put more effort in? Whatever it is, you know, maybe I'm not like the right daughter-in-law, maybe not the right sister-in-law. I'm not doing the job I'm supposed to do. Everyone else seems to know what's going on, but I don't. And so this is something that really happens to a lot of people. This is pervasive throughout society. I would say 70% of people at some point in their lives feel that way. And maybe it's like a dinner that you like get honored for, and you're like, yeah, but they're not honoring me because like I did anything because I'm special. Like, they needed someone, and like, I mean, like the right age group, I'm like well connected, and so they don't really think that I'm of value, just that like I can help them out, but I don't matter. And I think that imposter syndrome is a feeling that Ding Xiaowu had for sure. And I'll tell you why. Because God tells him so. This I did not know about until Ray Brand pointed out to me. This, I think, is fascinating. We have one more source about Shaul on the bottom of page 3. Where Shmuel is talking to Shaul. And this is after Shaul's made a few mistakes in his kingship. And I'm going to read in Hebrew because it's so powerful in Hebrew. In the second line, that, you know, God spoke to me last night and told me to tell you this. Vayam Shmuel. Halo im katon ata be'necha roshif te Yisrael ata. V'yim shaka kaka Hashem l'melech al Yisrael. Shaul, you think that you're small. You think that you're not deserving to be king. God appointed you to be king. You're not small. You're literally the man. You're literally head and shoulders above everyone else in the nation. Everyone loves you. Everyone thinks you're wonderful. You totally deserve to be king, but you're convinced that you don't. You're convinced that you shouldn't be here, which is why you're failing, which is why you're not going to succeed, why you're not going to become king. Then you contrast it with his successor, with David, who as like a kid has this whole scene with Goliath where he seems totally inadequate. But he's like, well, if this is what I'm supposed to be doing, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And he takes down Goliath, which is like this whole big elaborate story until Malcolm Gladwell destroys the whole thing in his book, David and Goliath. There's also a TED Talk about it. It's his only TED Talk, which is not his only TED Talk, but whatever. He ruins the whole story. It makes you feel like it wasn't impressive at all. Feel free to check it out. It's like 17 minutes, and he's a great storyteller. But Shaul, I think, is plagued by imposter syndrome. He's like, I don't deserve to be here. And so he keeps messing up. Because one of the things that happens when you have imposter syndrome is that you try and compensate. Oh, I got a promotion. I'm not really deserving of the promotion. I'm not really qualified, but I can't let anyone catch me. I can't let anyone find out. So I'm going to work really hard. And you'll have people who just put their whole life into work to try and make sure that they do it right. And you'll have parents who are like neurotic. Not because they're so, of course, they're deeply concerned about their child, but also because they're like, well, I don't know what I'm doing, but I got to make sure I don't do anything wrong. So they try to do whatever they possibly can to not mess up. So Shaul starts trying to overcompensate and ends up messing up, doing the wrong thing. So that's his mistake. And that, I think, is what's going on with Shaul. But now we have Rachel. Why is Rachel not davening? Because she says, God wants... This part is from the sources. But she says, God wants to hear my husband daven. God wants to hear Yaakov, I'm married to him. He's a tremendous tzaddik. He's a righteous person. He's a big rabbi. But I'm like a little nothing. Like, you know, where did I come from? Like, I'm not so impressive. Maybe I don't deserve to be one of the mothers of the Jewish people. And so she doesn't daven, not because she doesn't think davening is worthwhile, but because she doesn't think that her davening is worthwhile, that she's not worth it. And so Yaakov gets upset at her, said, how can you possibly think that you're not good enough? So Rachel never davens. Eventually she does. Rachel is actually very interesting. Rachel conquers her imposter syndrome because as soon as she has a son, she names him Yosef. But the name Yosef, all of those kids have like a funny names. They weren't funny because they were going to be the names of like what a lot of people name their kids. But like my rabbi had like a crazy story with like a wife that was incredible and that had cancer and passed away, and then another wife, and for 20 years he was married to extraordinary women and was never able to have children. When he finally did have a child, forgetting the name now, but when he finally did have a child, he didn't name him like Jacob. He named him some name that he made up because he knows Hebrew well enough, and it was some like gift of God kind of thing. But all the names of the children are something, you know. You know, Reuven, God saw my suffering, you know, and Yehuda, you know, Leah saying, I'm going to be grateful that I had this child. And so Rachel names her son Yosef. Yosef li ben Acher, I want another child. She has her first kid. She hasn't had a kid in a long time. She wants to have another one. It's like a little bit rude. But she says, no, if God thinks that I'm good enough to have children, then I want another one. I want to be more of a mother of the Jewish people. I want to have at least two, like everyone else. And so she realizes that she may have been feeling like an imposter, but maybe it was because her husband yelled at her, maybe it was something else. Hard to imagine Yaakov yelling at her was really what did it, but something happened. And it clicked in her mind, and she was able to daven. And so she has this Yosef. Then we get to Moshe. Before we get to Moshe, let's look at something. I don't know if any of you are on the Neely or the Cole emails, but on Monday mornings, where I brand, and where Brand's not around, then usually me, will learns a book called Ali Shur, which is written by Rosh Lomo Volbi. Volbi was a fascinating character. He's a Baal Tshuva. He became from the University of Berlin, which is like a classic, which is like hilarious. And apparently there was like a Chabad in the University of Berlin in like, you know, 1920s. I don't know exactly how it happened, where it came from, but he becomes from, and he becomes this big rabbi, a mashgiach. He speaks in all his yeshivot. And Revolvi had very, very keen psychological insights and like really like understood the depth of a person, and it comes out in the Sefer. And so Rabbi Brand learns it on Monday mornings, if anybody wants to schlep down to the Wi-Fi building from 9:15 to 9:45 on Mondays. I highly recommend it. I see, now we have a ring. But we're not going to look at this inside of it. We don't have a translation for it because it's too hard to translate. But it's a correspondence he has with one of his students. And his student reaches out to him and he's like, this isn't going so well. I'm in yeshiva and I feel like it's not going. It says any holy. I'm not succeeding. You know, I used to be able to like understand what's going on well in class. Class and I had like great ideas and it was awesome, it was exciting, and it's just not so fun anymore. You could have like semesters where like things just aren't going well, and one of the beautiful things about Revolvi is that he might be talking to a yeshiva student, but the things you're saying don't really just apply to yeshiva students. So there are times in our lives where we just feel like it's not going well. You know, like I was successful. You know, these things were exciting. Exciting. I was getting up when I wanted to get up. I was exercising. I was doing the things I wanted to do. The relationships I was having were clicking, and sometimes they just not. And so his student reaches out and says, what do I do? It's not working. So Revolvi says, first of all, we know that it's not just like a problem in you, because it used to work, and now it's just not. And he says, what's really happening? This is beautiful. He says, you're hanging out with all your friends, and you're looking around, and you're seeing that everyone is being so successful, that her kids are perfect, and every picture on her Instagram, like the kids are fully dressed, which is already in itself an accomplishment, and they're going on wonderful vacations, everyone's having such a good time, and you look over there, and the desserts they make are delicious, and this person's always in order, and everyone's always happy, and everyone's successful, and these people are getting promotions, and everything's going well for other people, and they're not going well for you. And you're like, well, how come things aren't going well for me? There must be some problem with me. And he says, when you feel bad about yourself because you're seeing what other people have and what you don't, no, that they're succeeding, that they're really smart, that they're really accomplished, that they work really hard, that they can do all the things, and you feel bad about yourself, he says, that's a very, very concrete concern. That's called jealousy. Sometimes being jealous is, oh, this is a beautiful table that I'm so jealous I wish I had. I prefer footrests.
You prefer what?
I prefer footrests.
Oh.
Sometimes it's, you know, you're jealous that a person has a thing, and sometimes you're jealous that a person has an ability that you don't have, or that they succeed in some way that you don't. And he says that when you look around and feel bad about yourself because of it, that's also jealousy. Not just, oh, I'm upset that this person has what I want, but that this person has something that I don't have, it must be a problem with me. So I think actually, according to Revolvi, imposter syndrome is really, in some ways, jealousy. And so if it's jealousy, and jealousy about who I am versus who you are, then there's an easy way to solve it. Okay, we have time for this story. We'll hopefully be done in 7 minutes. I worked for NCSY for 5 years before I came to Chicago. And I'm at Yerkes College, which is like their big Shabbaton. So when it was my first Shabbaton, it was very exciting. There's all these things going on. And there are these two NCSYers who I'm sitting with on Thursday night, and we're learning together for like an hour. And I'm like sharing ideas, they're asking questions, and they're like eating up everything I'm saying. It's wonderful. And there's a female advisor who's like sitting with us, who like once in a while would like chime in. Basically, I'm doing all the talking. As you can tell, I like doing that. And for like 45 minutes, I'm talking. And they're like, awesome, awesome. They're loving asking questions, really thinking. They're really engaged. You can like tell when someone's really in it. And said something. And then and the female advisor's like, oh, that reminds me of a quote I just saw from Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. The day you were born is the day God decided that the world could not exist without you.
My husband said that to my daughters.
That's so cute. Aww. Well, so I'm sitting there at this NCSY show, and there are these two NCSYs in front of me who've been eating up everything I said for 45 minutes. She drops that one line, and the girl and the female NCSY is like, oh, that's really good, and she writes it down. Like, I've been sitting here for 45 minutes. You haven't written down anything? But that you write down? So this is forever ingrained in my memory. I'll never, ever forget this line. But Ravoli basically says, how do you get out of this? How do you get out of feeling like an imposter? Out of feeling like you need to overcompensate because you're not good enough? How do you stop thinking that other people are better than you? Maybe you're not trying to get the promotion, not trying for the thing that you want because you don't think that you deserve it. So you got to remember that God created the world and created every individual in it and said that, Moshe, you're supposed to lead the Jewish people out. Oh, you're convinced that someone who isn't a good orator, someone who's not impressive, can't do it? I don't care. I put you in this world to take the Jewish people out. Everyone has their life circumstance, and yes, you know, there's the decisions that we made along the way, but where we are is where we're meant to be. And if I was given this position, if I was given these children, if I was given this family, it means that I'm supposed to have that. And psychologically, there are a few approaches, a few ideas about why, you know, how to navigate around it. I'm happy to share links and books that you can look at, but I don't think it's so complicated. I think Ravoli sort of hits the nail on the head. If you're really convinced that you know in your heart that you were put into this world for a reason, that you were born because God said the world can't go on without you, then there's no reason to feel like an imposter because what you're doing is obviously important. Now, to just tell yourself, I'm important, actually doesn't help. But to not just hear it, not just say it, but to feel it, to know internally, that's something that can really help. Then you're not going to feel like an imposter. Then you can be seemingly totally unqualified and say, okay, I'm going to roll with it. I'll be okay. Basically, everyone's unqualified until they are qualified. How many experts do you know? And if you ask them, they're like, I guess I'm an expert because no one else knows more than I do about it, but I'm an expert. Yeah, that's what makes you an expert. One of the things that's special about people is that we don't naturally think about ourselves. We don't need to think about ourselves that we're so extraordinary. We naturally think about ourselves and look at the rest of the world as being bigger than us. You know, like when we start out as kids, the world literally is bigger than us. I was just in LA at the Broad Museum, and they have a giant dining room table. It's very cool. And I'm like, this is probably how my dog feels. But when you grow up, you're like trained almost that everything's big. People are big. You know, couches are big. Tables are big. And we don't always grow out of that. We don't always realize, actually, I'm big now also. It's like so disappointing when you go to a playground that you remember being huge and the slide that was massive. And you're like, oh, this is as tall as I am. Okay. But we often don't translate that in other ways. We're used to being surrounded by people who know more than us. We go to school and I don't know as much math as my teacher does. At a certain point in time, you'll know more math than the person next to you. And only if you recognize that you're put here for a reason will that really resonate, will that really stick. Now, what's the difference? I'm going to skip the last piece. It's fun, but not necessary. But so I guess we'll just wrap up in the last minute or two that we have. A lot of people, whether it's, you know, characters in Tanakh, whether it's Rachel Yemenu, it's Moshe, it's King Shaul, will often be handicapped by their hesitation, their fear of not being right for the job. It's So sometimes they'll mess up a chul. Sometimes God has to yell at them for a week and force them. And sometimes their husbands have to force them. But when Rachel learns her lesson, she's like, no, I'm going to pray. And Rachel forever is remembered as a woman who prays and who has the ability to pray because she realized that I really can. It's not that I didn't have children because I'm not good enough to pray. It's that I didn't have children because my prayer is so strong. And so she becomes the ultimate woman to pray. She's the one who takes care of the Jewish people in exile. Moshe, who says, I'm not a man of words, as we saw in the beginning, the entire last book of the Torah is called Deuteronomy and Devarim. Devarim means words. The entire last book is just Moshe talking. It's a 5-week speech, probably very exciting for everyone. But it's a 5-week speech of Moshe talking. This is a guy who says, like, I have a stammer, I have a lisp, I can't do it. And then the end of his life, he just talks because that's what needs to happen. He says, okay, I'm going to do it. But only if you recognize that you were put in this world for a reason, well, you can be able to do that. So I hope this was interesting, I hope it was informative, and I hope you guys had fun.
Yeah.
Thank you. I don't know what's going to happen next. I don't know who the next person is, but I guess you'll coordinate with...